Welcome to the Donna Sebo Show. Donna is an international mental practitioner, award-winning author, counselor, speaker, teacher, and radio TV personality. Dedicated to empowering others through her mental skills, she also features authors and experts from all over the world to share their knowledge and experience with you, the listening audience. Now, let's join Donna and her guests. Here's Donna.
Hello, and welcome to an hour of Mind Power with Donna Sebo. We are going to be talking green for this next hour, but perhaps on a level that maybe you have never had the opportunity to hear about before. My guest today is Huey Johnson. We're going to be talking about green plans. What are they? Well, these are blueprints for what he describes as a sustainable earth. I want to welcome Huey Johnson to the show. Hello.
Hi.
I'm so delighted to have you today. I was so impressed by this book because you gave so much information about what we can do as individuals, but also what governments can do, nations can do to make a difference. Huey, you are the founder and president of the Resource Renewal Institute in San Francisco.
Correct.
Tell us a little bit about this group, how it got started, and what its mission is.
I have had a long career in the environmental area and was after starting the Trust for Public Land, I spent a time in government as a person in charge of the environment on the governor's cabinet. And after leaving that, was impressed by what was possible at that time or what was unlikely to happen, but it gave me an opportunity to go around and look for better ways of doing it than California was doing it at that time, that is, environmental management. And I found in Europe that there were fascinating examples of small countries that had advanced well beyond kind of thinking I'd been doing, and they ended up in the Netherlands, particularly, and they had moved about 100 years ahead of us in deciding that they were going to correct their environmental problems, and they did so in a fascinating way that it was led by industry, the chemical industry and others, and that impressed me no end, and I started studying what they were doing and was more and more impressed. It's still going on in good fashion. The interesting initial story with industry taking the lead in a Dutch example, they were invited by an Eastern European nation to come and tell this European nation, now freed from the Soviet Union, how to function and manage a free enterprise. And I believe it was probably Poland, had looked around and said, well, gee, we're supposed to manage with a free enterprise system. We better invite somebody in to tell us how to do it. And they decided they would invite some of the leaders from one nation or another. And they looked over the various nations, Germany, Australia, the U.S., and so on. No. They really liked Holland. And housing was taken care of, and they were prosperous one thing or another. And so the Dutch business leaders got in an airplane, flew to Poland, got off the plane, and looked around and were stunned at what they saw, that all the waters were polluted, children playing in pollution, and air quality so bad they could hardly see. And they realized that night after dinner, they were sitting in their hotel together, and said, good grief, we thought this is what we wanted, no involvement from government. But, man, we don't want this. And they said, you know, we better go back home and think this out. So the next day they told their hosts they're sorry they couldn't help them. Got back in the plane, flew back to Holland, and started thinking about it. And they decided they'd go to government and say, look, we know how to clean up these problems. You know how to set the goals. Let's cooperate in that way. So that's what they did. And the environmental movement, the militants were set up outside the room, in essence, where the negotiations were going on. and they would pass review on whatever decisions were being made between government and industry inside. And they did that because the environmental movement would be trusted by the public and they could send out their daily press releases. And anyway, it worked very well, and their economy was booming and continued to boom. They put together a 25-year plan for total recovery at every level, and they had cooperation of industry, and they've gone on from there ever since.
Now, Poland is really coming up beautifully.
Yes, they are. In fact, most of those Eastern European nations have made remarkable progress in this little notice. Poland is one example. Yeah.
You have a quote at the beginning part of your book, George Kennan. The hour may be late, but there's nothing that says it is too late. There is nothing in man's plight that his vision, if he cared to cultivate it, and his will, if he cared to exercise it, could not alleviate. The challenge is to see what could be done, and then have the heart and resolution to attempt it. You bring out some very interesting points in your book, and we'll touch on as many as we can during our time together. But you talk about the Netherlands, which you've already mentioned, Singapore and New Zealand. This is your primary focus, these three arenas of the world. And you make a comment that the Canadians had had a green plan, but it basically totally disappeared.
Right.
And it just is not in place in any way, shape, or form. We have a lot of stuff going on here in this country. There's a lot of people that are doing the best that they possibly can. They really are supportive, and the public has become more and more supportive. Why is it that you focused, I know about the Netherlands, but why New Zealand and why Singapore? Why did these other two areas stand out so much in example that you put them in the book? Because each of them have their particulars that I found quite interesting.
Well, they were early in getting into the issue and had established working programs that are impressive, as is Holland. Theirs is a bit different because they're basically an ag exporting nation, in the New Zealand case. And Singapore is highly industrial, but they had some of the very earliest serious government regulations when Singapore became independent, and some of their early political leaders were very green. They were conservative, but very green. And so there was a track record in those countries to show what their success had been as well as their failures. And the real dilemma we run into is that in judging a program of a city or a nation, for instance, there's a lot written down about plans and strategies and one thing or another, but there has to be accomplishments or further discussion about what they tried and what worked and what they now have achieved, etc. And these countries, particularly the Dutch, wrote all that down because they're concerned about the future.
Mm-hmm.
And in their case, climate change, the seas get higher, the seas could come over the levee in Holland and reclaim about a third of the country, for instance.
Easily, yes.
So they've got a lot of incentive to get out ahead. So New Zealand has done the same in a rather startling fashion. We have a film that was done by a Seattle educational TV station some years ago. They spent a month in Holland, a month in New Zealand filming, and I would be glad to share a copy of that with anyone if they wanted to write and get it.
Oh, I'd love to have that, yes.
Yep.
Well, what I wanted to bring out are some statements that you make. One, the environmental problems that we are seeing today, the pollution of water, the use of pesticides, processing of waste, all of these variables, they can be taken care of affordably. It doesn't have to cost gazillions of dollars, and it's going to benefit everyone. And we've gotten to the point, the bottom line, health and the quality of life. The oceans, many waterways, are overfished. there was information about areas in China where for centuries people had been able to fish. Now they are not able to do that at all. The fish that they get are so small that they have to try to get as many as they can to feed their families. This is a kind of ice fishing during the winter, an area of China, I don't recall the name. They used to have 500-pound sturgeon in the waters there. It doesn't exist anymore, to the best of their knowledge. You've got the problem of starvation on a massive scale because many areas in the world, the soils are destroyed. They are totally depleted of nutritional capabilities because of pesticides and over-fertilization. We have had it here in the United States. We've got a history of so many things going on in this country. But it's not just here. It's all over the world. So to come out of that ignorance takes effort. Now, in Holland, you said in 1988, Queen Beatrix made an annual Christmas speech and announced the changes for the entire country. And the population accepted it. Why do you think that was so, I can't say it's easy, but why do you think that her decisiveness had such a positive impact?
Well, she is allowed to give one speech not written for her a year. And that's the speech on Christmas Eve. And that year she, speaking in the radio, said, I'm sitting aside the speech I prepared for this hour. Normally she would bless someone for keeping their finger in the dike this year and someone else for taking care of the tulips and so on in a formal kind of a knighting process and so on. And the country, and those England as well, loved to listen to the monarchy on that day.
Mm-hmm.
And so she said, and I'm going to talk about a subject that is so difficult as to be, you know, earth-shaking to us, and that is there may not be any Dutch great-grandchildren. And then she went on to explain, though, the Dutch scientists had recently done a study of comparing the Dutch environmental regulations to other places in the world, and they turned out to be some of the best, that that in this case, they weren't good enough, and environmental quality was in decline, and that Dutch society could be out as a result.
Mm-hmm.
And that so shocked the nation that some various people got together, and including were some environmental leaders, I mean industrial leaders, huge corporations, including the chemical industry and Royal Dutch Shell and others, and they concluded that what they had been trying to do hadn't worked, that they'd sued government for everything they had tried to do forever, and that by and large had been expensive, and they were viewed with distaste by the public generally, and as polluters and so on. And so they said, you know, we could probably do this better, and that's when they went to decide to do a most radical thing, which is to go to government and to suggest they take the leadership in providing a better way of doing things, and that they themselves would undertake the process of cleaning up. They knew how to do that better than anybody else did, and what they would ask government to do then is to set standards that had to be achieved. They worked together and came up with a decision that they would have 25 years for total recovery. And that would mean at every level, and they would give the participants, industry, the pollution sources, flexibility to decide what part of it they wanted to deal with each year.
Interesting.
Then they'd report back. And now they're in there about their 20th year, and they're remarkably on target.
You make your statement in the book that cooperation really works, and that when business, nonprofit organizations, people across the board are willing to cooperate with each other, not war, but be willing to cooperate with each other, there is accomplishment. There is tremendous accomplishment. Also, there was public reporting in Holland and yearly independent assessments that kept track of the progress. this wasn't something that was just, well, we'll let you, you know, get by, we'll pat you on the head, and then you can go do whatever you want to do. Go ahead and play in the sandbox. That's not the attitude. The attitude was one of accountability. And that was brought up very significantly in the information that you present in your book, Green Plans. And what was so fascinating to me is that in Holland, the businesses didn't get up in arms over this because they really realized that their success, long-term success, and their standards that they were implementing were going to have a positive result in the eyes of the public.
That's right. And it worked very well. It was not all of industry wanted to do it, by the way. But enough did, and enough that they were, I think the public was somewhat startled by their offer of leadership, that they supported them, and they were given immediate, certainly, acknowledgement in the media for what they were trying to do, and it helped cover some of the difficult decisions they had to make on compromises, I suppose. And they went on to solve a lot of their programs. They had these goals, total recovery in 25 years, goals at shorter periods along the way. And this is all available, often much of it, on their internet sites, and or our internet site as well for the Source Renewal Institute. But it is a nifty place to see what can be done when people do cooperate.
And, oh, I think it's fabulous.
Yeah.
And you make a comment in your material about the European Union that it has given notification to the manufacturers in the United States, the Silicon Valley manufacturers, that they won't be allowed to export computers to Europe unless they comply with European standards regarding toxic materials used in their construction. So already they are on that curve. They've invested in research and development, saying, how can we do this better so that we're not poisoning ourselves and other places? One of the biggest challenges I think that we have today in the United States is we have a lot of scrap that is sent to various countries. And it involves lead, it involves mercury, various items, materials, and a lot of computers, old used computers, are shipped out of the country. And they're shipped into countries that they go and they disassemble them, but there's all of this toxic exposure that goes out. And it's going out into their environment. We end up buying the product back. It really is quite, when we become aware of what goes on, it's really quite a concern because there is so much that needs to be looked at on a global basis. Now, with Holland and Singapore and, you know, with them, are they careful about the products they bring into their country? I know Holland is. I know the European Union is making a statement. But what about Singapore?
Singapore would be a more open trading entity, but it is a city-state, and it has remarkable programs in effect to maintain the quality of life in Singapore, the water, the transportation, parking, manufacturing, one way or another. The European Union is so powerful because it's half... It's about 500 million people, 27 nations. And thus, they have a larger market than the U.S. does.
Mm-hmm.
And so when they have started making these environmental pronouncements that you will not bring anything in to any one of our 27 nations that violates our environmental standards, they suddenly are setting standards for the world. Where we used to, we advocated that, and now... if Australia or Germany or Singapore or anybody else wants to export over there, they have to conform to the EU standards. And that is thus having a huge impact.
Well, I know with the beef industry, and correct me if I'm wrong, but U.S. beef has been rejected by European countries because of hormones and some other items that are fed to our animals. And this is of a concern to them. They're sort of they're sort of ahead of us in a certain way, but they have really got a lot of research and science behind much of their choice, or choices, I should say, that they are making.
That's correct. And that was, for them, pretty courageous to do when they announced that they were going to make these standards apply, and I think we, frankly, made a mistake in trying to stare them down. We have as our ambassador from the United States to the EU, which is the major diplomatic office there, a former coal lobbyist who's a close friend of Mr. Bush, and he is over there trying to weaken their environmental laws as much as he's doing anything else, and that makes them cynical about us as well.
Well, I think it's going backwards. We
yeah.
can't go back to the 1940s. It doesn't work.
That's right.
We're in 2000-plus, and by golly, it's time to wake up. Things that worked, you know, at the earlier part of the 20th century, the world is so different today. It's not going to work. We've got to get our fossilized thinking out and let it air out and put it in the right place, in the Museum of History, and let the advancement move on. Singapore deals with a water issue. And here in the United States, we have areas that are experiencing drought. In many ways, it's not a surprise, but in other ways, it's quite a concern because of the population density that we have today. You give information about a program that they call the four-tap strategy. What is that?
Would you repeat that? In fact, let me just shift to another office, if I may.
Okay.
There's nothing noise going on here that I'm where I am. I'll put you on hold.
All right, my guest, while he's shifting to the other phone, is Huey D. Johnson. His fabulous book is called Green Plans, Blueprint for Sustainable Earth. And this is a book. If you want to know what's going on in other parts of the world, you're going to want to know about this. Huey, you're back with us? He's going to another office.
Hello?
Hello, Huey. There we go.
There we go.
The question that I was asking was about the four-tap strategy of Singapore. Can you tell us what that is?
They've had a similar development to that in both New Zealand and Holland, where industry is in a position to cooperate and deliver the environmental standards that are being sought. And they have thus evolved a strategy to achieve and maintain environmental quality at standards that provide a dramatic example for Asia and places like China and India are very critical to the future of the U.S. and our ability to have a quality of life as well.
Mm-hmm.
And so what they're doing, though they're a small country, is far more important in its daily happening than we might expect it to be.
Well, I know that the Prime Minister, Yu, has had an extremely intense drive towards the wellness of his country. And he became aware that Malaysia was becoming very barren of trees and that it was going to cost Singapore a lot in more ways than one, especially when it came to rain, because Malaysia has the rainforest. So he started a tree program. He has been adamantly strong about cleaning up the waterways. Where the water was heavily polluted before, that has changed. He consulted with the Worldwide Fund for Nature to find out how to plant trees and flowers so that they would get more of the birds and various critters around. And he has held industry accountable. And I found this information fascinating. The heads of the corporations are held responsible for the environmental violations. And if they're found to violate, a letter of warning is sent. If the problem is not corrected, A second letter of warning carries with it a stiff penalty. This is amazing.
Level jail sentence.
Yeah. Oh, it's a jail sentence.
Yeah.
Interesting.
Yeah.
But it's the head of the corporation, so it's the people at the top, which is, you know, that's reasonable. They are held accountable. The old adage is what the attitude of the management is at the top permeates the entire organization. And
yeah,
that has been proven time and time again.
They never had to send a second letter. By the time the president gets that letter with that threat, he starts ringing bells and pulling ropes.
I can imagine he starts ringing bells and pulling ropes. New Zealand is a country that is not very large. They have taken on a very, very aggressive campaign with their own environment. And all of this information, I mean, they're putting in trees. They had, what, 35% of their forest left? That's
yeah.
all?
Yeah.
But now they've got a big project on to save the trees and to grow more trees. And the people of New Zealand are actively participating in this.
And they have remarkable results. I think in each of these cases, when you judge them, a critic would really worry, well, can the country thrive economically if it's becoming very green like these countries are? And you can look at the place of the dollar against the currency of those countries, including the EU particularly, and see exactly they have benefited tremendously. They know exactly what the cost of things are because they're managing their affairs that way.
Mm-hmm.
And we haven't a foggy notion. And the free hand has been free, but it hasn't helped environmentally.
Well, I found it fascinating that in New Zealand, and this was done overnight, I don't know that it would happen here in the U.S. that quickly, but the subsidies for farmers and for many other aspects were totally cut off.
Overnight.
Overnight. That was just amazing to me. And what happened is that instead of devastating the agricultural community, as so many people might have imagined, it did anything but that.
Yeah.
They became more resourceful. They pulled together. They got things done. They weren't being paid for not being efficient. I mean, it was amazing. Think of what could happen here.
That's right. And there are books on many of these subjects, the New Zealand agricultural success, when it suddenly had its subsidies removed, is in book form. And we would list it, I think, on an internet site, or you could contact the New Zealand embassy in Washington and ask them for that.
Well, that's amazing. Now, Huey, your organization, which is the Resource Renewal Institute in San Francisco, what is your website?
Let's see, I guess we've got several. One would be, make it my initial, HDJ at RRI, for the Resource Renewal Institute, .org. So HDJ at RRI.org.
Okay, HDJ at RRI.org.
Yes.
Okay, and I'm sure they could type in Resource Renewal Institute and something would pop up too.
Right.
Now, your book, Green Plans, is so well done. You have such good information. You list a number of websites that if people are interested in finding out more, checking with different places in the world, it's right here in your book. What a wonderful, wonderful publication this is. And I think that you will, in your own lifetime, see the results of much of this, maybe right here in the United States, where it's
I'm beginning to be optimistic.
I continue to be optimistic myself.
Let me add a thought here. We are going to have a one-day conference on October 16th in the Bay Area here in San Francisco, and we're bringing over some of the original thinkers from Holland and New Zealand who put together their green plans and have been with them all these years, and we would be delighted to have anybody attend.
Oh, that would be wonderful. Well, I'm sorry we're out of time. There's so much more I could share, but we just are out of time. Huey Johnson his wonderful book, Green Plans, Blueprint for a Sustainable Earth. Type in Resource Renewal Institute in San Francisco. Go to the website, hdj@rri.org, and you will be able to find out more. It's a must read if you want to know what's going on in the world and what you can do to make a difference. This is Donna Sebo. Thank you again, Huey, for being
Thank
my guest.
Thank you very much.
This is Donna Sebo. We're taking a break. Don't go anywhere. I've got good stuff to share with you today. We'll be right back.
Donna Sebo publishes a popular, inspirational, and insightful newsletter filled with information about her upcoming guests, her travel schedule, seminar presentations, and upbeat articles to lighten up your life. You can subscribe to this free monthly newsletter by emailing her at donna@delphiinternational.com. That's donna@delphiinternational.com. You can also go to her website, www.delphiinternational.com, and review past publications. Keep in touch with Donna through this monthly publication. Again, her email address is donna@delphiinternational.com, and her website is www.delphiinternational.com.
Do you want to lose weight? Do you deal with diabetes, high blood pressure, osteoporosis, or chronic pain? Do you want to know one of Dr. Perricone's 7 secrets to beauty, health, and longevity? Do you have 15 minutes a day to look and feel better? Then let me introduce you to TTAP, the workout that works. For the beginner or expert exerciser, learn from physical training specialist Teresa Tapp how, in just 15 minutes a day, you can burn fat and sugar, build strong bones and muscles, and lose inches fast with no equipment or jumping. Visit the TTAP website, ttap.com, or call 1-800-342-0717 to learn how. That's TTAPP.com. We'll help you lose inches, look good, and feel fabulous at TTAP. 1-800-342-0717. TTAP.com.
Hi, this is Donna Sebo. Give me a buzz if you'd like to chat. Telephone number to call in to is 877-876-5227. That's 877-876-5227. Canadians, 888-815-9756. That's 888-815-9756. Also, we have a direct line of 530-876-3222. And if you are a first-time listener, I'm so delighted you've been able to join us. All you need to do is give me a buzz. I want to know your first name or initial, and then after that, hey, I'll give you my perspectives and insights. And, of course, you're going to be able to ask a question if you so desire. Again, Donna Sebo here, 877-876-5227, 888-815-9756, or 530-876-3222. Tomorrow we're going to have as a guest Danny Kofsky. We're going to be talking about how to survive or perhaps thrive on a teacher's salary. Now, whether you're a teacher or not, this is good information to have because I'll tell you what, he gives some financial basics that if you are on, let's say, a lower level of income, you're going to know how to use it more effectively, and if you've got more money coming in, hey, that just adds to the mix, and you can really do a lot of what he did, be very effective, and end up having a financially secure life. So Danny's going to be with us tomorrow. The Alchemo Woman, Ramona Rubio, is going to be on with us on Thursday. We're going to be talking about the changes that women have gone through and the changes that they can choose to experience if they so desire. And then Louise Lewis on Friday, a great way to end the week, no experts needed. Aha, does that cause you to raise your eyebrows and go, I wonder what that's going to be about? Well, I hope so, because if it does, that's the reason I'm saying it that way. Donna Sebo here, give me a buzz if you'd like to chat, 877-876-5227 or 888-815-9756. Words are so important. But there are a lot of words that are used by people constantly, and they don't know why or where they came from. Why do we use them? Why did the particular definition evolve? Well, I know my husband is someone that just really loves studying words, and this is something that I really didn't have too much of an interest with. But hey, after you've been married to someone for 30 years, you start to develop the interest in these areas little by little. But the use of words is so important. Now, what about the word dunce? Do you have any idea how that came about? Well, it came about because of a person that was considered absolutely brilliant during the Middle Ages. Now, his name is John Duns Scotus. Now, he didn't have any intention on making this word turn out the way that it did, but in the long term, he ended up giving his name to fools. Now, what happened is that he had teachings which, after his death in 1308, and during the Renaissance, scholars at Oxford, Paris, and Cologne who supported his ideas were labeled dunsers, D-U-N-S-E-R-S. He had no idea that that is what was going to happen. They took his middle name, they made it a little longer, and called them dunsers. And that's where the word dunce evolved from. Now, what about eavesdrop? We use that. We'll say someone's eavesdropping. Where did that come from? Well, long before we had roof guttering, houses in medieval England used to have very wide eaves so that the rain cascading off their thatched roofs wouldn't soak into their foundations. Well, we still try to build that way, don't we? But we have rain gutters. Now, people who lurked near doors and windows to overhear conversations had to stand in this eavesdrop space to be close enough to listen. And so that's how the word eavesdroppers came about. And doughboy. Well, some of you may not be familiar with it, but those that are familiar with terms that came out of, well, the doughboy term was used in the 1800s. And originally, doughboys were round dough cakes. That's right. They were like little donuts. They were served to American sailors aboard their ships. But from the late 1840s, the term came to be applied to American soldiers because the large brass buttons on their uniforms looked like the cakes. There's a little trivia for you. Donna Sebo here. Give me a buzz if you'd like to chat. 877-876-5227. Now, by the way, I want to thank those of you who are sending me some wonderful, wonderful stories. I downloaded a lot of information today, and I didn't have a chance to get it all together so I could use it on the show. But I have got some wonderful, wonderful stories and tidbits and all kinds of goodies that I'm going to be able to share with you. If you have a special story that you'd like to share with me, if you have a joke, if you have information that you think my listeners might enjoy, send me an email. Send it to Donna at DelphiInternational.com. That's Donna at DelphiInternational.com. And then that way, when the time is appropriate, I will use it, and we will be able to share whatever you've found, because I don't know everything. Surprise, surprise, I don't. So anyway, if you'll do that, that's just great, and I will be glad to share it on the air. One of the stories that I wanted to share with you was about a woman, Amy Jaffe Barzac. She is quite a gal, because she is changing the lives of children across the country. And I want to tell Amy's story. She got involved with children because one day she was holding her four-month-old son in her lap when she saw a little girl that was sitting in a wheelchair at a playground that she used to take her son to quite frequently. And she went over and started talking to the little girl, and the little girl was watching the other children playing, and she said, "Oh, I wish I could do that." And Amy thought to herself, "You know, I wish you could too," but she was in a wheelchair, so she had to be dealing with different issues. Well, there was a dream, a seed for a dream that was planted in Amy's subconscious. This had a very, very deep effect on her, because the little boy that she was holding in her lap, her baby son, was not going to survive. He had a rare progressive neurological condition, and he was going to be dying at a fairly young age. Well, her baby didn't live very long. When she lost him, it was really very, very hard on her, as you could imagine it would be for just about any mother. Now, while her child was dying, she came to know a hospice worker. And the hospice worker made a comment to her. To help Amy with her healing, she made this suggestion. She said, "Why don't you think of something you can do in your son's honor? There's nothing you can do about the disease that he has. This isn't your fault. There's nothing here to blame. But how would you like to have him remembered?" Well, it was just like the hospice worker had said. Amy had had this little seed of an idea regarding children that were handicapped, children that were in wheelchairs. So she happened, after her son died, to go past the playground, and they said, "That's what we need to do. We need to build a playground that would be our son's legacy. And know that if he were playing in it, he would just love it as much as the other children would." Now, within 2 weeks after her baby boy died, she started working on the new playground. She decided the playground needed ramps instead of steps, smooth paths instead of wood chips, and it needed high back swings. And she kept seeing this little girl in the wheelchair. And she said all children could play on this playground. It wouldn't just be an either or. All children could play. Now, she didn't know anything about building playgrounds, but for 18 months, she made phone calls, she did web searches, she even started asking for donations. Finally, she ended up having the funds for this playground. She got a lot of volunteers that helped to assemble it, and the kids came in to play in this playground from all around. No matter what their physical condition was, they could play on this playground. And the mothers and fathers were just thrilled. Well, what happened? Her playground, which is called Boundless Playgrounds, started getting attention. People wanted to have her build a playground in their area. And this is what some of the people said. They said now their daughter could swing side by side with the sister. And then there's a 9-year-old that was in a wheelchair said, "Let me do it myself. I can play the way I want to play." And there are mothers throughout 24 states that have already built or modified 150 playgrounds. 150 playgrounds. That's awesome. Now, this is where you go to find out about what she's doing if you're interested. It's boundlessplaygrounds.org. Boundlessplaygrounds.org. She helps people get started with this anywhere and everywhere. She said, "I hope someday we're not going to be needed anymore because all the playgrounds will be like this. Until then, I see my son Jonathan in all the smiles of all the children's faces, and I can't help thinking, well, we knew we'd do something to remember him by." And there's just so much that this benefits with children. Remember, when children play, and I know today so much physical education has been eliminated from the school curriculum, kids have to play. They need to run. They need to be active, even children that are handicapped. I just watched a video that somebody sent me about a little boy, one leg, playing baseball. I'm going to share his story with you, too. Incredible stuff. He's out there running bases. One leg, folks. No prosthesis. Amazing. Kids need exercise. Then in the playgrounds, they have a chance to make friends. But more than anything else, it encourages that self-sufficiency that makes such a difference. This is Donna Sebo. We're going to take a break. Don't go away. I've got more good things to share. And you want to call me, 877-876-5227 or 888-815-9756. We'll be right back.
Are you concerned about nutrition? Do you work hard to eat right, try to feed yourself and your family nutritious food? Well, you'll want to know about glyconutrients. What are they? These are sugars that are present in nature, however, we're not getting them in our food anymore. Scientific study is proving that these sugars are necessary for all cellular and immune system function. Over 20,000 studies are conducted each year on glycoforms alone. These are the sugar protein structure that line each and every cell of the body. 4 out of the last 8 Nobel Prizes in physiology have been awarded for research in the area of cellular communication and how these sugars work in the body. This is Donna Sebo. Every day I bring to you information that will empower and light up your life. I would like to invite you to visit my website, DelphiInternational.com, and find out more about these glyconutrients. That's DelphiInternational.com. Go to my website, go to the left side of the screen, tap on the button that says glyconutrients. MIT's Technology Review, February 2003, states that glycomics is one of the 10 emerging technologies that will change the world. Education is the key to advancement of understanding and making our lives better. Visit my site, DelphiInternational.com. Go to the left side of the screen and tap on the button that says glyconutrients. I know it'll make a difference for you, as it has for me.
Hi, this is Donna. Give me a buzz if you'd like to chat, 877-876-5227 or 888-815-9756. And remember, all I need is your first name or initial. Let's go to our caller. Hello, welcome to the show. First name or initial, and where are you calling from?
My name is Elaine. I'm calling from New Jersey.
Hi, Elaine. Welcome to the show. Where in New Jersey?
In Wayne, New Jersey.
In Wayne. I didn't hear that when you said it. Okay, Elaine, the first thing I'm looking at is you are going to deal with some financial issues, and I'm getting the number 6, so I'm not quite sure whether it's 6 months or 6 weeks. I don't think it's 6 days, but it's coming up in the cycle of 6. You're going to need to look at how you want to arrange your financial planning so that you are not going to be caught short cash-wise. There is a lot that is going to be coming up into your environment in a very unique way that is going to cause you to shift your attention to a new level of thinking. And as you're shifting your attention, you're going to find that it's a little scary for you because you're going to be challenged. You can meet the challenge. You're not going to have a problem at all. But the shift is going to be one that will enable you to release what you have been afraid to let go of. And so this is on many levels of your life. It's mental, physical, spiritual, and emotional. So this is a major shift that is coming in. And again, there's something here with finances, so I want you to be aware. I want you to be alert, not fearful, but aware that you are going to be able to make the shifts and changes that you need to do, and you won't have to feel like you're going backwards. Not at all. Do you have a question for me today?
Is it a positive shift or a negative shift?
It is going to actually be a positive shift for you. You may, on initial perception, might not see it that way because of old patternings in your thinking. You're going to try to compare with what's gone on in the past, but that's not where you need to come from. It's being open and receptive and saying, all right, if I've got these things I have to pay attention to, how do I deal with them so I can deal with them effectively, thoroughly, and efficiently? All of this will come into play very, very well, very, very nicely. But it's going to force a change that, again, initially you may think is terrible, but it's not really.
Is it a long-term change or short-term?
No. It actually is something that is going to happen very quickly, and then the results of the effectiveness of the change will show themselves within 2009. So it's going, like I said, it's either 6 weeks or 6 months, but it has a wonderful long-term effect on you starting in 2009.
Oh, I hope so.
What would you like to ask me today?
I'd like to know who was stealing flowers for the mausoleums. Like, we'd flip flowers for my mother. A few times they had stolen them, and one time they had vandalized it. Is it a worker, or is it somebody that just comes in and...
Well, I think that you've got a person here that is doing it to others as well.
Yes, they are.
So what you have got is a person that has issues in dealing with death. They have beliefs regarding cemeteries, and what they're trying to do is make a statement with this. And I think what I would do is, whoever is taking the flowers, I hope that you're enjoying them and that whoever receives them will appreciate them. You do something in the way of a little note, but talk to the people at the cemetery.
We have.
Yeah, and this is someone that's doing this on a regular basis. I do think that this person that is doing it, actually I'm looking at two people that I think are involved. One is a male and one is a female. And the female, I think, has some emotional issues here. And I don't think they're really wanting to be nasty or ugly. I just think it's a belief system that they have.
What kind of belief system? They get pleasure in taking... I feel there's bad karma if you steal from a cemetery like that.
No, I don't think so, dear. That's a perception that is your perception, but I don't think it's their perception. I really don't. And the reality is the people that are buried there, they're not there anymore anyway. You're honoring and respecting the person that you love that is there, as are other people. That is why they've always been so important, and I appreciate that, and that is very meaningful to people. However, I don't think I'd make this too big an issue. I would just maybe leave a note or ask that you can do that, you know, at the mortuary. They may not want you to do it, but say, can I leave a note for this person saying, please, where whoever gets these flowers, I hope they appreciate them and honor them as much as I do in honoring my mother's memory. Just something. You can come up with something that's very subtle, and don't say it's bad karma for you or anything else, because that's not going to reach them. But I think the flowers are actually finding their way onto someone's table.
And they're taking it home to their homes, right?
I don't know whose home it's going to.
I know. That's what I figured.
But it's landing on someone's table. So, just know, this will stop, I think, within about a year. I think they're going to find out who's doing it. And I really don't think that this is a horribly bad person. I just think that they're dealing with a kind of distortion in their own mind, and this is the way that they're doing it. They're taking the flowers.
And could you tell me how my mother's doing on the other side, and is she aware of me? Does she come around? Is she around me?
Well, you know the answer to that question. And you know your mother is doing very, very well.
What is she actually doing on the other side?
I don't know. At this moment, I don't know. But I can tell you that your mom would be very, very productive, because that's who she is as a person.
Yes, she is.
Very productive. But I'm not able to answer some of your other questions for you.
Can you come to any messages? Would she have any?
No, I don't have anything for you at this moment,
okay.
Dear.
Do you have a name of the spirit guide for me?
No, I'm sorry, I don't.
You don't do spirit guides?
No, not in the way that many people do. Not at all. I believe that there are those people on the other side that are with us, but I also know that they change and they shift as we change and shift as people. And I think you as an individual are growing into a whole new level of yourself, where a lot of this anxiousness that you have is going to dissipate. You're going to be more at peace with yourself. I'm running out of time, dear.
Okay.
I've got to go.
Thank you.
You have a wonderful day.
Thank you, too.
This is Donna Sebo. And don't forget, tomorrow we're going to be talking about money. And who isn't interested in that? We all need it, and we all can learn how to manage our dollars even better. So this is something I think that you'll find interesting. And Danny is such a nice guy. And this little book that he put out, How to Survive and Thrive on a Teacher's Salary, it is worth reading and it's worth knowing about. And we're going to share a lot of that with you tomorrow. Remember always, you're the master of your fate. You are the captain of your soul. Life is rich. Life is good. Savor its wonder. It's there for you and it's all free. Enjoy. This is Donna Sebo. We'll see you here at same time, same place, bbsradio.com. Bye for now.
You have been listening to The Donna Sebo Show. If you would like a copy of today's broadcast, send $10 to The Donna Sebo Show, P.O. Box 97272, Tacoma, Washington, 98497-0272. Be sure to put the date of the broadcast in your request. If you are not able to be a part of today's program, join Donna and her guests Monday through Friday, and she will be here to take your calls. Thank you for listening and being part of our program. Have a wonderful day.